roof was to cover an unsupported area more than 6 feet in width. Time-tested in two world wars, in which the 105mm had been the standard field artillery weapon, the average tonnage of engineering materials necessary to protect a unit of a given size was known to the last ton. To protect one squad against enemy artillery, 30 tons of engineering materials were required. Building a combat bunker for one automatic weapon required 12 tons. To entrench a full battalion, 55 squad dugouts and 75 automatic weapons bunkers were required, a total of 2,550 tons of engineering materials plus 500 tons of barbed wire and accessories. Sudra thus calculated that in order to satisfactorily fortify Dien Bien Phu for the initial garrison of 10 infantry and 2 artillery battalions, he needed 36,000 tons of materials. The only way to reduce the logistic burden was to substitute local materials for those to be brought in by airlift. The hope of finding suitable construction wood within the valley or on the surrounding hills soon evaporated. Even by literally taking apart every building and shed in the town and the surrounding villages, a measure which the population rightly considered a barbarism and which threw it automatically on the communist side, only a few hundred cubic yards of construction wood could be secured. The high bamboo stands found in the valley were excellent for kindling wood, but of no value whatever for construction that had to resist heavy loads. Woodcutting parties sent into the surrounding hills proved about as impracticable as the reconnaissance raids of GAP-2. The woodcutting parties would be ambushed, and soon required large bodies of protective troops. Once the wood was cut, the small pool of transport vehicles was hardly suitable for heavy transport, even if it were possible to get the trucks far enough into the roadless jungle to pick up the wood. Nevertheless, between the dismantled tribal houses and the wood cut along the rim of the valley, Sudra succeeded in collecting about 2,200 tons of construction wood. This left Dien Bien Phu about 34,000 tons short of minimal engineering requirements. The chances for a successful defense of Dien Bien Phu under direct attack could be expressed in one frightening equation. 34,000 tons of engineering equipment represented the cargo loads of about 12,000 flights of C-47 transport aircraft, the standard aircraft then available in Indochina. About 80 aircraft were deployed on the daily run to Dien Bien Phu. At that rate, and assuming that nothing else but engineering materials were flown into Dien Bien Phu, 5 months would have been required to make the forlorn valley into a defensible field position. Sudra, as well as his superiors, knew that they would not have 5 months, and that there would not be 12,000 C-47 flights. When Sudra presented his calculations to Ducastri's staff, he met with incredulity bordering on derision. With heavy battles going on in Laos, Dien Bien Phu's airlift allocation barely reached the 150-ton-per-day level necessary to maintain the normal supply requirements. Orders, as we have seen, had been given to cut down on ammunition expenditure. Undeterred, Sudra continued to argue that he had been given the responsibility not only of preparing Dien Bien Phu for a long siege, but also of providing the fortress with 2 airfields. A second airfield was being prepared north of Strongpoint Isabel, 2 heavy-duty bridges, and electrical power and purified drinking water for over 10,000 men. Yet there was just so much that could be squeezed into the airlift. Ducastri and presumably General Cogny and his staff made the decision to allocate about 4,000 tons of engineering materials to the fortress. Roughly, this tonnage was broken down as follows. 3,000 tons represented barbed wire and accessories, 510 tons represented PSPs for the 2 airfields, 44 tons were made up of Bailey Bridge elements, 70 tons were devoted to 5 bulldozers, one of which had participated in the Italian campaign of 1943, and 23 tons represented mines and other explosives. A total of 118.5 tons represented the allocation of wooden beams for the construction of protected foxholes and bunkers for the troops. The engineers were thus about 30,000 tons short of minimal requirements. That leaves us with exactly enough materials to protect the headquarters command post, the signal center, and the X-ray room of the underground hospital, said Sudra. The rest of Dien Bien Phu will have to get on as best as it can. And that was exactly what happened. Engineering was not the only problem that would make the construction of adequate defenses at Dien Bien Phu an almost hopeless task. In addition to the tonnage requirements which the engineering manuals demanded, there were the approximate time and manpower requirements for the construction of field fortifications. Thus, to construct a squad dugout capable of protecting 10 men against field artillery, a 40-man platoon would have to put in 8 days of work. To construct a bunker for automatic weapons, the same platoon would require 5 days. A whole battalion would have to work at nothing else but its protection for about 2 months to insure itself against the kind of artillery bombardment that Dien Bien Phu was led to expect, and which, indeed, it got. Additional time would have to be allotted for the construction of communication trenches, the laying of minefields, and the building of adequate protection for the lightly manned service units that could not possibly spare men for the task. Headquarters units, artillery, air control, armor, and quartermaster in maintenance. Yet the available manpower obviously could not be devoted entirely to the task of position building. The GAP-2 was almost constantly engaged in reconnaissance operations, and most of the other infantry units were so often engaged in close-in combat operations that they were able to devote scarcely any time to a fortification program that had to be pushed with the utmost energy if it was to be successful. Furthermore, the many hesitations and counterorders emanating from Hanoi and Saigon until almost 30 days before the onset of the actual battle were not conducive to a coordinated fortification effort. After all, there was General Cogny's long-standing hope that, thanks to wide-swinging offensive operations centered on the valley, an actual duel inside the valley would not last long enough to make permanent fortifications worthwhile. This opinion, it will be remembered, was shared by General Navarre. Added to this was the opinion of both the artillery specialists and the bomber command that any strong concentration of enemy artillery would undoubtedly be knocked out before it could do serious damage. Lastly, there was the fact that until late February there had been no clear idea as to where the field fortifications were to be constructed and how many men were going to occupy them. Indeed, by messages of February 3rd and 6th, Hanoi told de Castries to undertake studies for a modified position at Dien Bien Phu held by only 6 battalions for the duration of the monsoon season, that is, from April to September. The reply which de Castries sent Cogny on February 15th, based on studies made on the spot by Major Soudrat and his engineers, was equally frank in commenting on the position as it then existed and in what it implied about its fate should the battle occur during the rainy season. The work on the present defensive system is practically completed. In any case, the lack of materials, barbed wire, does not permit me to pursue certain improvements, particularly the construction of internal enclosures between the strong points. The same shortage of materials permits only the barest sketching in of interval strong points between the eastern hills destined to ensure the close-in defense of the supply dump zone. De Castries furthermore expressed the fear that his supply dumps, now located in the valley bottom near the Nam Yom, would be flooded when the rain started for good, and sent Cogny a map overlay clearly showing how much of his then-held position would be underwater. Farther south, as De Castries noted, Strong Point Isabel would be almost totally flooded, and he recommended that it be abolished altogether. Lastly, said De Castries, since the flooded areas cover the whole southern and western part of Strong Point Claudine, the whole strong point will have to be pushed northward, and a new bridge will have to be constructed across the Nam Yum, since the present bridge will disappear under an expanse of water of 300 meters. De Castries also recommended that further fortifications, instead of being dug into the ground where they would be necessarily flooded, be constructed above ground. What is amazing about this communication is that it contains, on De Castries' part, the simultaneous affirmation that his defense works are practically completed and that he lacks construction materials to such an extent that there was not enough barbed wire to seal off the various internal parts of each strong point from one another and to build the vitally important interval strong points that would prevent enemy infiltrations between the key hill positions covering the northeastern face of the fortress. Both shortcomings were to prove decisive once the battle was joined. The absence of sufficient barriers inside the strong points made it difficult to seal off the Viet Minh whenever they achieved a breakthrough, and during the crucial battles of March 30th through April 3rd, 1954, important positions of hills Dominique and Elian were lost to lateral infiltrations, which interval positions could have blocked. As it was, the project of getting Dien Bien Phu out of the water, as the saying went, never materialized, for lack of time and materials. When the rains came in April, That year they were both earlier and heavier than usual. Nearly all strong points immediately took water, and Isabel in particular almost disappeared in the quagmire. The rains also weakened the already flimsily built bunkers and trenches. There was hardly a man in Dien Bien Phu who did not at least once find himself buried under his collapsed dugout. Another surprising element in the preparation of Dien Bien Phu for battle was the absence of any attempt at concealment and camouflage. The urgent needs for construction wood led, to be sure, to the almost immediate felling of all the trees in the position area. The trees were followed within a short time by all the bushes, which were used as fuel for the hundreds of cooking fires of the garrison. The constant marching to and fro of 10,000 men, 118 vehicles, 10 tanks, and 5 bulldozers took care of the grass. Within a few weeks, even the slightest slit trench or the smallest bunker entrance inside Dien Bien Phu outlined itself against the brown, earthy background of the valley like a Chinese ink drawing. Each artillery piece and mortar could be seen from far away, glistening in its wide-open firing position. And since there was neither space nor materials available for alternate gun positions, enemy observers hidden in the hills were able accurately to pinpoint every heavy weapon in the fortress. In some cases, the very meticulousness of the job done contributed to the defenders' difficulties. The Foreign Legion always prided itself on the workmanlike execution of its fortifications. As one of the officers of the 31st Engineers was to observe, the firing slits of the dug-in automatic weapons soon acquired a telltale dark powder color against the surrounding sand and earth, and it soon became the habit of some of the particularly ambitious weapons crews to actually paint the firing slits black. No doubt the fortifications impressed the high-ranking French, American, British, and Vietnamese generals and other civilian dignitaries who kept visiting Dien Bien Phu in a steady stream, but unfortunately they left absolutely nothing to the imagination of the enemy. Little wonder, then, that the enemy artillery, once the battle began in earnest, immediately registered in on the most sensitive targets with devastating effect. Another dead giveaway of important positions at Dien Bien Phu was the tall radio whip aerials gently swaying in the wind over every command post and battery position. Of the 1,400 sets within Dien Bien Phu, at least 300 required outside aerials, and in some places they were as dense as the bamboo hedges which had been destroyed to make place for them. The answer given to visitors who wondered at the absence of any kind of camouflage was that enemy observers in the hills were capable of seeing everything that went on in the valley. The answer is not fully satisfactory. Camouflage nets over some of the most important communications trenches and battery positions would have at least prevented the enemy from obtaining exact timetables of French troop rotations and patrol reliefs. In some cases, they would have delayed the enemy's immediate observation of the damage his fire had caused. In certain instances, the bareness of the terrain was unavoidable. Most of the artillery pieces, for example, had to be capable of firing in all directions, and therefore could not be dug in, and the battalion strongpoint commanders were haunted by the thought, based on dire previous experience elsewhere in Indochina, that the slightest shred of vegetation would be used by the enemy to camouflage his approach prior to an assault. As it turned out, the enemy instead chose to drive approach trenches as close as possible to the French positions, from which they emerged at the opportune moment under the cover of their own artillery fire. There were other major engineering tasks to be accomplished inside Dien Bien Phu. Since early December, Dien Bien Phu had also been host to an ever-increasing detachment of observation and fighter aircraft, notably 6 light observation aircraft of the 21st Artillery Air Observation Group, GAOA, of Captain Robert Durand, and a flight of fighter bombers from the Fighter Group 122 Saint-Ong under Major Jacques Guérin, who was also to become the senior air officer in the fortress. Since they realized that these aircraft would become essential in a prolonged defense of Dien Bien Phu, the French had constructed veritable dugouts away from the airstrip itself, where the aircraft would be parked during the night or when not in service. Major Sudrat's engineers had built another bridge leading from the airfield to the dugout area, which the airplanes easily crossed under their own power. A third bridge was built at Strongpoint Isabel to provide access to the southern airstrip located to the east of Road 41 on the far side of the Nam Yum. To save precious building materials, Sudrat had bulldozed the riverbank into the Nam Yum to a distance of 20 feet in order to build a narrower bridge span. As it turned out, The southern airstrip, located in the midst of a plain which was completely undefended, was never used. Major Garin landed an empty C-47 transport aircraft on it to test the feasibility of landings on the unimproved strip. But as long as the PSP-covered main airfield was available, there was no reason for using the southern strip. When the northern airfield became unusable, the southern strip was already under enemy fire. Finally, when it became clear that the battle for Dien Bien Phu might be a prolonged one, a last-minute attempt was made to save the large supply depots of the fortress from flooding by digging new supply emplacements along the steep western edge of Hill Dominique. The new depot emplacements required that 2.5-ton trucks would have access to the other side of the Nam Yum, so Sudra had to build a 44-ton Bailey bridge across the river to connect the depot area with the rest of the valley. Again, the back-breaking labor proved useless. With the other urgent commitments inside the fortress, the depots were never transferred to Dominique. The bridge soon came under such intensive fire that it was useless for communications. It was much safer and easier to ford or swim across the Nam Yum. Since much of Dominique fell into communist hands as early as March 30th, it turned out to be fortunate that the project was not carried out. Another major task of the engineers was to provide drinking water for 15,000 men. The Nam Yum and its tributaries, like all tropical rivers, were heavily polluted. Anyone drinking the water was certain to become a victim of amoebic dysentery. Hence, the engineers installed 4 water purifiers weighing a total of 16 tons, which provided drinkable water for the garrison. The main water purifier, heavily dug in and operated by a single man, provided water to the central strong points until the end of the battle. Yet, as the fighting grew in severity, the water-carrying parties suffered heavy losses, and the men began to resort to drinking the relatively clean rainwater, of which there soon was more than anyone wished. Another major problem for the engineers was providing Dien Bien Phu with the necessary electrical power. There were 15 power generators and 5 battery chargers at Dien Bien Phu, providing electric light to the main strong points and command posts, and power for the various radio and telephone installations, as well as to the X-ray room and operating room of the underground hospital. Here also, engineering miracles were accomplished by repair teams who kept the main generators going throughout the battle and kept the power lines, which had to be laid into the soggy ground and were often lying in pools of water, in operating condition. In fact, so urgent were the needs for power that 2 generators were parachuted into the fortress while the battle raged. One of them smashed on landing, while the other landed upright and undamaged, but proved, in view of its weight, unmovable by hand under fire. Aside from the fortifications, 2 other factors were to play a decisive role in the defense of Dien Bien Phu, the tanks and the artillery. As it became clearer that the battle would have to be fought in the valley, de Castries counted firmly on the massive use of firepower and the relative mobility of his forces to destroy the enemy before he could decisively harm the garrison. In fact, on December 19th, de Castries had sent a message to his subordinate commanders in which he traced the outlines of the battle as he saw it. "The battle of annihilation which I expect to lead in the valley of Dien Bien Phu rests essentially, 1. On an ensemble of 5 centers of resistance which form the infrastructure of the static defense and which shall define on the terrain the area of the desirable battlefield. 2. On the ability to concentrate on every point of the battlefield at least 4/5 of all the firepower available to me. 3. And on a full scale of prepared counterattacks. The mission of the centers of resistance, which at certain moments could be completely encircled, is to hold without any thought of withdrawal, even if one of their constituent strong points were to be taken by the enemy. It will be their task, under the best of circumstances, to reoccupy the lost strong point by a local counterattack, or, at the very least, to neutralize it by their proper fires and by calling upon the means at the disposal of GONO. The counterattacks will, as a matter of principle, be led by the commander of the 2nd Airborne Group." De Castries, who had been selected for the Dien Bien Phu command on the strength of his reputation as an armored cavalryman, did not lose sight of the possibility of using tanks. Early in December, he requested that a light squadron of M-24 General Chaffee tanks be airlifted to Dien Bien Phu. This request implied that the tanks would have to be dismantled in Hanoi and rebuilt from scratch inside the fortress. 10 of the 18-ton vehicles, they were factory new and had recently been delivered to the French by U.S. military aid, were brought to Dien Bien Phu during the month of December in a small separate airlift. The shipment of each tank required 5 C-47s and 2 British-built Bristol freight aircraft with frontal clamshell doors that accompanied the tank hull, weighing 4 tons. Within a few days, the mechanics of the 2nd Automobile Repair Company of the 5th Foreign Legion Regiment, 25 CRALE, under Lieutenant Bouguet, had laid out what seemed to be a small-size reproduction of the original tank assembly line in Detroit, save for the fact that it was located in the midst of a jungle valley with sand winds reaching gale force. Each piece of equipment, particularly the engines, had to be cleaned 100 times from the all-pervasive sand before it could be installed. The only heavy tool available for the assembly line was a lifting rig. The Legionnaires had borrowed it from the artillery, which was used to place the huge engines into the tank hulls. Everything else was done by hand. One fully assembled tank was produced every 2 days. On Christmas Day 1953, an armored platoon of 3 tanks under the command of Master Sergeant Aristide Caret from the Moroccan Colonial Infantry Regiment, RICM, became operational. On December 29th, de Castries sent a routine message to Hanoi requesting that a 3rd tank platoon be assigned to Dien Bien Phu and that the small squadron be given its own command staff. In the files of the French Army, this message bears a handwritten inscription scribbled across one of its corners signed by Lieutenant Colonel Deneff, General Cogny's Deputy Chief of Staff. Take a captain from the 1st Regiment of Chasseurs, 1 RCC, Captain Hervouet. And thus the fate of a man was sealed. Captain Yves Hervouet, who was to command what became the 3rd Squadron of the 1st Regiment of Light Infantry at Dien Bien Phu, had until recently been in Morocco as the aide to Field Marshal Alphonse Juin, and had volunteered for combat duty in Indochina. He had recently been assigned to the 1st RCC in the Red River Delta. A quiet and studious-looking young man, with his glasses half-trimmed in gold, Hervouet was well-liked by everyone, but particularly by Lieutenant Colonel Langlais, with whose GAP-2 Hervouet was to cooperate very closely in the last reconnaissance battles prior to the outbreak of the Viet Minh attack. When he was assigned to Dien Bien Phu, Hervouet had just had an accident and commanded his tanks with his left arm in a plaster cast and sling, wounded in the other arm as he led his tanks into battle during the communist thrust against Elian on March 30th to 31st, he continued to command his Bisons, as they were affectionately known at Dien Bien Phu, to the last day. Hervouet was to die of exhaustion on the death march to the communist prison camps in June 1954. By January 17th, all 3 tank platoons had become operational. Hervouet, his little staff, and 2 of the tank platoons under Sergeants Caret and Gunz stayed in the main fortress. The 3rd platoon, commanded by Lieutenant Henri Préau, went southward to reinforce Strongpoint Isabelle. On February 1st, Hervé's tanks fought their first engagement northeast of Hill Gabriel. As it became clear that the battle for Dien Bien Phu was going to be a slugging match, the French High Command decided to provide Dien Bien Phu with sufficient heavy firepower to enable it to destroy the enemy's field pieces by counter-battery fire, and to smash his infantry attacks against the strongpoints by withering protective fires. In addition to the artillery inside the fortress, there was the firepower of the fighter bombers and B-26s of the French Air Force and Navy. Above all, there was the cumulative experience of the French artillery commanders. Ever since Napoleon, the French, not unlike the Russians, had prided themselves on the efficiency and know-how of their artillerists. In World War I, the French 75 not only outstripped its German equivalent, but it became the standard field gun of the U.S. Army as well. In Indochina, many of the senior commands were in the hands of artillerymen, such as General Cogny. The deputy commander of Dien Bien Phu was 48-year-old artillery colonel Charles Piroth. Piroth's jovial exterior and friendly round face hid a sensitive personality. He was an excellent choice for the job. Although seriously wounded in Italy in 1943, where he had lost his left arm almost to the shoulder, Piroth had remained on active duty. In Indochina, he had commanded the 69th African Artillery Regiment, notably in the Street Without Joy operation of 1953. In Coigny's view, Perrault the artilleryman would be an excellent complement to de Castries the cavalryman. Perrault assumed command on December 7th, the day the first major artillery unit of what was to become the permanent garrison began to be airlifted into the valley. It was the 3rd Artillery Group of the 10th Colonial Artillery Regiment, 310 RAC, under the command of Major Alliu. The 310 RAC had been the Organic Artillery Battalion of the 13th Foreign Legion Half Brigade, DBLE, which was also being transferred to Dien Bien Phu, and thus it was familiar with the infantry units with which it would have to fight. With its full 3 batteries of 4 American 105mm howitzers each, the 310 RAC represented quite an impressive fire element. It was reinforced by mid-December with the 2nd Group of the 4th Colonial Artillery Regiment, 24 RAC, commanded at first by Major Urkabi and later, during the actual battle, by Major Necht. The 4th RAC was one of France's oldest artillery units permanently stationed in Asia. Its shell-scarred flag bore the battle streamers of the conquest of Tonkin of 1883-85 and of the Boxer Rebellion of Peking in 1900. It fought in the hopeless rearguard actions against the Japanese in 1940 and in 1945, and a handful of its men fought their way into nationalist China rather than surrender to the enemy. In 1951, a new 4th Artillery Group was added to the normal complement of 3 groups of the regiment, and that unit was equipped with brand new American 155mm medium howitzers served by Moroccan gun crews. The 155s were the largest field pieces available in Indochina, and their booming voices often spelled the end of a communist attack on outlying posts in the Red River Delta. In addition, there were 3 heavy mortar companies equipped with French 120mm 4.2-inch mortars, whose plunging fire should have been capable of destroying most of the enemy's entrenchments. Relatively small and easy to handle, the 120s did not require the complicated firing pits necessary for the howitzers. On the other hand, they did not have the range of the latter, nor their precision. The 1st Foreign Legion Airborne Heavy Mortar Company, commanded by Lieutenant Erwan Bergot, took up positions on Strongpoint Claudine. The 1st Composite Mortar Company of the 3rd Foreign Legion Infantry took up positions on Anne-Marie, and the 2nd Composite Mortar Company of the 5th Foreign Legion Infantry transported its 8 pieces of 120mm and 4 of 81mm to Strongpoint Gabriel on December 27, 1953. Finally, at the suggestion of an American officer, Major Vaughan, who had witnessed their devastating effect in Korea and had, in Hanoi, mentioned it to the commander of the French anti-aircraft artillery, 2 quadruple mounts of 50-caliber machine guns were transported to Dien Bien Phu. In Korea, the Quad 50s, as they were nicknamed, had done a terrifyingly effective job of hacking to pieces massed attacks of communist infantry. They were to do the same job at Dien Bien Phu. Electrically swiveling on their mount, they would fire 2 of their 4 barrels at once, while 2 barrels were always in reserve. Many communist attacks, having smashed through the French infantry and silenced the French artillery, would be stopped by the throaty staccato of Lieutenant Redon's Quad 50s. In spite of many close calls, they remained effective until the end of the battle. Under the command of Colonel Perrault, the artillery of Dien Bien Phu was split into 2 major groups. Groupement A, which comprised the 310 RAC and 2 mortar companies, and Groupement B, which included the 24 RAC, the battery of 155s, 1 mortar company, and the Quad 50s. As Strongpoint Isabelle was installed to the south of Dien Bien Phu, Perrault decided to provide it with a fairly large amount of artillery designed to smash any possible enemy attacks against the southern part of Dien Bien Phu itself. Thus, on December 24th, the 8th Battery of the 310 RAC, Captain Rice, was transferred there, followed on January 23rd by the 7th Battery and a fire control center under Captain Noel. Captain Libier became the overall commander of the artillery at Isabelle. Finally, when the Battle of Dien Bien Phu was already raging and Isabelle was nearly cut off from the rest of the valley, the 9th Battery of the 310 RAC, Captain Rencourt, fought its way toward Isabelle under cover of a sortie of Isabelle's tank platoon and 3rd Battalion, 3rd Foreign Legion Regiment. This distribution of artillery apparently was justified by 2 factors. First was the size of the central position, which at its largest measured hardly more than a square mile and already contained 12 medium field guns, 4 heavy field guns, and 24 heavy mortars, as well as enormous stocks of ammunition. Second was the fact that both the southeastern strongpoint Elian and the southwestern strongpoint Claudine were considered particularly vulnerable and in need of additional fire protection, which Isabelle, located 5.5 kilometers to the south, could easily provide. Both de Castries and Pirot had foreseen that the brunt of the initial attack would be borne by the outlying strongpoints Gabriel and Beatrice. Gabriel, therefore, had its own heavy mortar company. Beatrice, on the other hand, had its normal complement of 81mm mortars, which were deemed sufficient for close-in defense against the surrounding communist hill positions, and could, of course, count on the support of the field guns from the main position. Herein lay the tragedy. When the battle unfolded on March 13th, communist artillery fire rapidly neutralized the main artillery positions inside Dien Bien Phu itself, while the field guns stationed at Isabelle found themselves beyond effective range of the northern strongpoints and thus were incapable of taking the place of the muzzled main artillery positions. As General Cartrou was to say later in his report, "It is possible to estimate that if the site chosen to establish Isabelle had been closer to the central position, its artillery would have been capable of supporting those essential strongpoints and could also have been reduced by an infantry battalion, which could have reinforced the reserves." There were other weaknesses. To spot enemy targets, the artillery had to rely on its observation posts, OPs, placed on the peripheral hill positions and on its own small squadron of 6 observation aircraft. Both the hilltop observation posts and the observation aircraft were lost during the first 48 hours of the battle. It was then too late to provide Dien Bien Phu with such electronic aids as target acquisition radars. In any case, it would have been doubtful that such delicate instruments would have long withstood the constant pounding of the communist artillery. In a report written after the battle by the surviving artillery commander, he simply noted that the artillery became progressively blind. Its only resource from then onward was the information provided by spotter planes from the 21st and 23rd Artillery Air Observation Group, who would brave the 3-hour round trip from the small Laotian airstrip at Muang Sai, as well as the communist flak over the valley. It had been reinforced by deadly 37mm pieces on February 11, 1954, to provide a measure of information about enemy movements. Reconnaissance aircraft of the French Air Force, along with daily aerial photography of the valley, provided additional information. But soon, all this would become largely irrelevant, as the artillery pieces concentrated on communist troops and trenches often a mere 1,000 feet away from their own pits. But none of this was known to de Castries and Pirot in December and January 1953-54. In fact, Pirot had worked out a plan for the destruction of the enemy's artillery, which he happily recited to each of the high-ranking visitors who called on the staff of the fortress. Firstly, the Viet Minh won't succeed in getting their artillery through to here. Secondly, if they do get here, we'll smash them. Thirdly, even if they manage to keep on shooting, they will be unable to supply their pieces with enough ammunition to do us any real harm. There is some evidence that Pirot was not entirely taken in by his own high spirits. In a personal letter of December 16, 1953, to his direct superior in Hanoi, Colonel de Winter, Pirot argued the fact that he had in Dien Bien Phu less artillery and manpower than that normally allocated to an infantry division, yet I need more men and more firepower. He was right. The garrison of Dien Bien Phu, with its 12 battalions, would have been entitled to 3 full artillery groups of 105mm guns and 1 full group of 155s. The heavy mortars, which were supposed to fill the gap, could hardly be considered an adequate replacement. Yet on the following day, when General Navarre visited Dien Bien Phu with General Coigny and the commander-in-chief of the French Far Eastern Air Force, General Lauzun, Pirot was his old self again. The generals, accompanied by de Castries and Pirot, had visited the freshly built strongpoint Beatrice, where Lieutenant Colonel Gaucher and part of his impeccably aligned 13th Foreign Legion Half-Brigade did the honors. Navarre had climbed on top of the command post bunker of Beatrice and was looking directly back along Road 41 into the heart of the valley, where the low hillocks of Dominique and Claudine could be seen as though they had been drawn on a map. Clearly, Navarre was worried. Beatrice was surrounded by impenetrable jungle hills, which could conceal scores of enemy heavy guns, and once Beatrice was in enemy hands, it was obvious that much of Dien Bien Phu was going to be under enemy fire. Pierre Schoendoerfer, a young reporter with the French Information Service in Indochina, who stood with the official party atop the bunker, distinctly recalled Pirot's reply. Mon général, no Viet Minh cannon will be able to fire 3 rounds before being destroyed by my artillery. Navarre looked at him, looked back at the vista of the valley beyond, and then said quietly, "Maybe so, but this won't be like Nassan." The same scenario was repeated on January 26, 1954, when Marc Jacquet, the French Secretary of State for Associated States Affairs, visited Dien Bien Phu. He had been impressed by Perrault's presentation of his counter-battery fires, but as a former Air Force officer, he was worried about the amount of protection available for the vital airstrip on which the survival of Dien Bien Phu eventually would have to depend. He also had been impressed by reports of massive use of American artillery to break communist human wave attacks in Korea. As Jacquet was leaving Perrault's command post, he turned back and said to the artillery commander, "Colonel, I know that there are hundreds of unemployed artillery pieces around Hanoi. Take advantage of the fact that a member of the government is here to get yourself some extra pickings on them." Pirot was alleged to have answered with indignation that, as he had shown the Secretary of State on his plans of fire, he had more guns than he could handle, and to General Blanc, the chief of general staff of the French army, who had come with Jacquet and who was an artilleryman by origin, Pirot said, "If I get 30 minutes of advance warning, my counter-battery will be effective." By the end of January, it had become obvious that the excellent camouflage of the enemy artillery, and even of the enemy's infantry positions, was going to be a major problem during the battle. In fact, Pirot was visibly preoccupied by the fact that his guns could not provide effective support for the sorties of GAP-2 and of the other battalions. Later, Major Jean Nicolas was to remember how Pirot came, with tears in his eyes, to Nicolas' Moroccan Rifle Battalion on Strongpoint Elian to present his apologies to the men for the shells from his guns that had fallen short on February 6th, injuring several Moroccans as they participated in the attack on Hills 754 and 781. The Moroccans, assembled by the embarrassed Nicolas, had listened to Pirot's apology in stony silence. Other signs of impending disaster appeared by mid-February 1954. A communist prisoner had been captured with drawings of underground artillery firing positions of an unorthodox design, which in effect would leave unprotected only the very small area of the firing tube itself. Basically, the process was not new. It presupposed that the artillery pieces would not have to be moved very often and would be able to cover only a relatively small zone within the target area, as had been the case during the stalemate years of the Korean War. The American forces, with a superabundance of bombers and artillery, had found it difficult to locate and destroy such guns, although in most cases the Korean terrain was barren of any sizable vegetation. Around the valley of Dien Bien Phu, on the other hand, vegetation was available in lush abundance. The French Air Force had long known that it was unable to photograph it by conventional means and had requested American assistance with newly developed infrared film. Between January 23rd and March 2nd, 1954, a Captain Hill of the U.S. Air Force had been on temporary duty in Hanoi to experiment with this infrared film and with newly developed camouflage detection film as well. Both had worked effectively in Korea. In Vietnam, they were total failures. All this had not been the case at Nassan the year before. There, the French positions formed 2 complete rings around the airstrip and covered all the high ground, and for miles around the terrain was fairly open and the sparse communist artillery was easily detected. At Dien Bien Phu, Pirot still clung to the hope that any kind of digging such as would be required for the shell-proof camouflaging of a large artillery force could not go undetected. It did. The French Air Force had picked up here and there evidence of the passage of heavy equipment. In fact, it is surprising how deadly accurate its estimates were. As early as December 27, 1953, French Air Force intelligence estimated that the enemy's total strength would be about 49,000 men, including 33,000 combatants, figures which would turn out to be within 10% of reality. As early as January 9th, aerial photography had shown that 105mm howitzers had left communist rear base areas in the direction of Dien Bien Phu. Whatever else it was, Dien Bien Phu was not an example of a failure in French intelligence. In fact, as early as February 16, 1954, Le Monde's veteran correspondent Robert Guillon reported from Dien Bien Phu all that had to be known about the Viet Minh's siege techniques. "Without us seeing it, the Viets built their positions right under our eyes," said Guillon, "and not on the reverse slope, but on the one facing us." Guillon, who had been to Korea, correctly stated that similar situations had existed there, but that fantastically dense American airstrikes usually overcame the obstacle and neutralized such positions. And he likewise identified, 1 month before the battle began and 4 months before it was lost, the key French weakness: airborne firepower. Guillon bluntly doubted that fire suppression missions flown by two fighters could seriously impede the enemy's activities and called them simili airstrikes. What Guillon knew, others knew as well. The French knew that in a set-piece battle it is preferable to hold the high ground, but they had counted on their firepower to compensate for their unfavorable positions. It was one of their key mistakes. On January 30, 1954, Major Privat, the French chief cartographer in Indochina, informed Navarre's headquarters in Saigon that the French large-scale maps for the Dien Bien Phu area were fairly inaccurate and scarcely usable for the precision maps required by the artillery. In Privat's words, "The maps are bad, and the artillery men in particular will notice it soon." A new large-scale map, which, as this writer knows from personal observation, also had its share of inaccuracies, hastily drawn from aerial photographs, was distributed at Dien Bien Phu, but it promptly fell into enemy hands during the abortive raid of Major Chanel's 2nd Thai Battalion. When it became apparent at the beginning of March that the French counter-battery was totally ineffectual in silencing the Viet Minh artillery, Pirot and his superiors in the artillery command in Hanoi sought to rectify the situation by last-minute measures. General Cogny, an artilleryman himself, ordered a full-scale review of the artillery situation in Dien Bien Phu during the first week of March 1954. By then, sufficient communist artillery fire had been received from enough different places to give an approximate idea of the enemy's capabilities. In addition, the deciphered communist logistics code had given the French a complete view of the number of communist artillery shells already in place within the battle area: 44,000 shells of 37mm, 5,000 of 75mm, 21,000 of 81mm, 15,000 of 105mm, and 3,000 of 120mm. Apparently, there were also some Russian 1943 model super-heavy 160mm mortars in the Dien Bien Phu battle area. Prepared in the cool atmosphere of a staff office in Hanoi, far away from the exhilarating atmosphere of a garrison which had been waiting now for 4 months to measure itself against an enemy who refused to come out into the open and fight, the new report of the artillery situation presented an all-too-accurate picture of what was going to be the fate of Dien Bien Phu. Total neutralization fire requires about 50 rounds per hour per hectare, 2.5 acres, of terrain. The Viet Minh is capable of delivering approximately 33 rounds per minute for a duration of 5 hours on the totality of the headquarters positions, the artillery and the mortars, while partially neutralizing Isabelle as well. The Viet Minh artillery is as numerous as ours, and its observation is better. The report reached General Cogny in person on March 9th. The archive copy bears in the left corner, along with his initials, the scribbled question, "Why wasn't that study made earlier?" The fortress of Dien Bien Phu began to take final shape during the last weeks of February 1954, behind its thousands of tons of barbed wire, around its unprotected gun emplacements bristling with artillery and heavy mortars, and under the cover of its shoddily built bunkers and foxholes, animated with the hope that its 10 light tanks and its handful of fighter bombers would keep the enemy at arm's length. One of the more curious aspects of Dien Bien Phu is the fact that the various errors committed in the physical construction of the fortress apparently remained hidden from the constant stream of French and foreign notables who inspected the valley in some detail prior to the outbreak of the battle. It was with understandable feeling that General Navarre was to write later that "Not a single civilian or military authoritative person, including French or foreign ministers, French service chiefs, or American generals, ever, to my knowledge, admitted any doubts before the attack on the ability of Dien Bien Phu to resist. This seems to have been true. Rarely had a frontline position deep behind enemy lines been the object of more high-level visits. As will be recalled, General Cogny himself first landed at Dien Bien Phu 2 days after its occupation, to be followed on November 24th by the British military attaché, Brigadier General Spears. On November 29th, Cogny returned to Dien Bien Phu and brought with him the Commander-in-Chief, General Navarre, as well as the Chief of the United States Military Assistance Advisory Group, MAAG, Major General Thomas Trapnell. Cogny returned again on December 4th and was followed on December 11th by his own Air Force commander, General Deschaux, who inspected the air facilities at Dien Bien Phu. Cogny himself returned on December 12th, accompanied by Navarre's deputy, General Baudet, the commander of French forces in Laos, Colonel de Crèvecoeur, and the British writer Graham Greene. On December 19th, General Trapnell, escorted by his own staff, returned to Dien Bien Phu and again expressed nothing but admiration for the job being done there. On Christmas Eve, Navarre and Cogny and a large part of their respective staffs arrived at Dien Bien Phu and spent Christmas with the troops. Navarre personally inspected one strong point after another and then attended midnight services in the midst of his soldiers on the open terrain. 4 days later, General Baudet, escorted by the commanding general of the French Far Eastern Air Force, Major General Henri Lausanne, and the Inspector General for the French Artillery in Indochina, Brigadier General Panaccioni, as well as General Cogny, again visited Dien Bien Phu. Each general had brought his own experts along, and they, in turn, had had long talks with their counterparts inside the fortress. One of the officers present kept a partial record of the subjects covered when General Baudet visited Dien Bien Phu. General Baudet apparently underlined the absolute necessity to maintain the airfield in working order at any price, and asked whether the strong points around it permitted the effective defense of the airstrip. He was reassured on that score by Colonel de Castri. General Lausanne, looking toward the north where Strong Point Gabriel stretched its ship-like shape, wondered aloud whether it would not be extremely dangerous to have to parachute supplies on Gabriel if it were to be cut off. Baudet, who also was an Air Force officer and who apparently had second thoughts about the efficiency of the airlift operations into Dien Bien Phu, stated that he would have liked to have a French air operations officer at Dien Bien Phu who had participated in the Berlin airlift of 1948. In contrast with General Navarre's claim, both Air Force generals present, and in particular General Lausanne, seemed uneasy about some of the tactical decisions made in the valley. Lausanne worried about Isabelle's probable inability to observe enemy anti-aircraft artillery, which could be concealed in the hills. He suggested that helicopters place observation teams along the whole crest line. Colonel de Castri, exhibiting the selective memory that often afflicts officers when faced with high-ranking superiors, seemed, according to the record, to have forgotten about his abortive attempts at breaking through to the hill line. He argued that he was too poor in helicopters to afford the risk of losing them on such missions. But, said de Castri, he would entrust the job of observing the crest line to native scouts. Lausanne then made one of those suggestions which, for a brief moment, clearly showed a lapse into another war and another era. He suggested that Isabelle could perhaps be equipped with a captive balloon for the purpose of spotting the enemy's flak. He apparently forgot that if the flak was accurate enough to be dangerous to his aircraft, it would surely quickly dispose of the captive balloon. It was also Lausanne who, while visiting Isabelle later that day, commented on the distances between the auxiliary southern airstrip and the surrounding mountains. The record shows that he received various answers. He pointed out that some of the ammunition dumps were situated too closely to the parking area of the aircraft. They were later hit by enemy fire and blew up with some of the aircraft, and let it be known that he was skeptical about Strong Point Gabriel. The record does not show that Lausanne's recommendations were acted upon, or that he expressed his reservations to his own commander-in-chief. In the meantime, the steady stream of high dignitaries continued. By now, de Castri had refined their visits to a well-rehearsed maneuver. The reception at the airfield by an honor guard of Moroccan riflemen in gleaming white turbans and webbings, a visit to the outlying strong points, preferably to the well-turned-out legionnaires at Beatrice, in de Castri's own jeep driven by himself, Lunch at De Castries' own command mess on an impeccably gleaming table service, a 30-minute briefing at his headquarters, and usually a brief glimpse of Dien Bien Phu at war, either a brief artillery demonstration impeccably fired by the African cannoneers of one of the batteries at Claudine, or a combat reconnaissance combining Captain Hervouet's brand new Chaffee tanks and Colonel Longley's lithe paratroopers. In January 1954, the visits of the high civilian dignitaries began. On January 3rd, Navarre and Cogny escorted the French High Commissioner in Indochina, Ambassador Maurice Dejean, for his first visit to Dien Bien Phu. On the 14th, there was another visit by General Trapnell, who beamingly hovered over this French military enterprise like a mother hen. His concern becomes somewhat more understandable when one realizes that the American equipment inside the fortress represented a donation of well over $10 million by American taxpayers. The day after Trapnell's visit, there was one by Cogny, and on January 22nd, one by Navarre. The latter came this time to prepare for the earlier mentioned visit by the French Secretary of State for Indo-Chinese Affairs, Monsieur Marc Jacquet, who was also escorted by the Chief of Staff of the French Army, General Blanc. On February 2nd, the highest-ranking American visitor, Lieutenant General John Iron Mike O'Daniel, arrived. He was United States Army Commander in the Pacific. O'Daniel inspected Dien Bien Phu with an important retinue of American officers, including some who had experience with communist anti-aircraft artillery in Korea. While O'Daniel's reports to Washington have thus far not been published, President Eisenhower released their gist in his own memoirs in 1963. In reply to a report from the late Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, to the effect that the French government had informed him that the war was going badly, President Eisenhower wired Dulles, who was then in Europe, on February 10, 1954, that General O'Daniel's most recent report is more encouraging than that given to you through French sources. In other words, O'Daniel, like the others, had been fooled by Dien Bien Phu. On that very same day, in Saigon, General Blanc gave a top-secret oral briefing, of which at least one stenographic record has remained. Given before both his civilian superiors, Pleban and Chevigné, Blanc apparently was blunt. By April 15th, the fortress would be a marsh, drowning in the monsoon rains, and to destroy the enemy's main battle force there was a pure illusion. That oral briefing at best led to a few more incisive questions on the part of Pleban when he reached the fortress himself, but to little else. And General Navarre did not hear of it until 1964. Yet at least three Americans were stationed at Dien Bien Phu almost until the battle was joined. One U.S. Air Force officer and two U.S. Army officers. The Air Force officer, Captain Robert M. Lloyd, was assigned by the U.S. Pacific Air Force, PACAF, to study the effects of communist anti-aircraft artillery on French air operations, while Lieutenant Colonels John M. Woner and Richard F. Hill from U.S. Army Pacific, USARPAC, observed the preparations of the battle from the vantage point of Colonel Jules Gaucher's Foreign Legion's 13th Half Brigade. In other words, American observation and advice were available to the French at all levels. There is no evidence whatever that the French were either advised against fighting at Dien Bien Phu or advised against any specific aspects of the defensive system of the valley. If such advice was ever given, that is, comments going beyond doubts expressed by one American observer to another, or to their own superiors, it is still cloaked in the secrecy of American archives. On February 7th, it was the turn of France's Secretary of Defense, Chevigné, to visit the valley, escorted by Cogny. The Secretary returned to Dien Bien Phu a week later, this time escorted by the Chairman of the French Joint Chiefs, General Paul Ely. Chevigné did not take his tour lightly, but stayed overnight and carefully visited every one of the strong points. A former regular army colonel, he was conversant with military problems in general. His visit was a reconnaissance for the visit of his Minister of Defense, Monsieur René Pleban, on February 19th. By then, both Cogny and Navarre were commuting forth and back between Dien Bien Phu and Hanoi, for both of them had been in the valley on the previous day in company with the French Army Surgeon General, Dr. Jean Sault, and the commanding medical officer for North Vietnam, Colonel Taramorsi, M.D. With Plevan's visit, it seems, the high point of Dien Bien Phu's period of outside inspections had been reached. True, the Honorable Malcolm MacDonald, Britain's High Commissioner for Southeast Asia, visited Dien Bien Phu on March 6, 1954, when its airfield already was under intermittent communist fire. Generals Navarre and Cogny made a last joint trip to Dien Bien Phu on March 4th. But most of the other visits now were by lower-level specialists working frantically just before what they knew would soon be the full-scale attack. On Friday morning, March 12th, General Cogny's command aircraft landed for the last time on Dien Bien Phu's main strip, already lined with the burned-out hulks of several aircraft destroyed by communist artillery. Cogny made a last visit to Beatrice, showing obvious signs of concern for its welfare if it were not properly supported by powerful counterattacks. Throughout the day, isolated communist shells, thus far fired from 75mm cannon and 120mm mortars, fell in a random pattern on many points in the valley, seemingly avoiding the parking area of the airfield, where Cogny's C-47 had stood all day. Other transport planes hurriedly trundled down the runway, dropped their loads, and took off again. At 15:30, Cogny returned to his aircraft, escorted by de Castries and his staff. Perhaps Cogny believed that this had merely been another of his inspection tours at Dien Bien Phu, but many of the men who stood at respectful attention as his tall silhouette disappeared inside the aircraft knew that they would not see him again before the end of the battle. As both engines of the airplane slowly turned over, a volley of 105mm howitzer shells crashed into the parking area, virtually boxing in the escort party now lying flat on the pierced steel plates of the taxi stand and setting afire two Cricket reconnaissance planes parked nearby. The C-47 took off in a cloud of dust and pulled in its wheels as soon as it was airborne. At 17:30, an F-8F Bearcat fighter bomber undergoing repairs was riddled by shrapnel. By the next day, six F-8Fs of the first group of the 22nd Fighter Wing, GC-122, Saint-Ange, would have disintegrated under enemy fire. Meanwhile, French intelligence had picked up a valuable bit of information. The communist political commissars had told the population in the villages to clear the valley by noon Saturday, March 13, 1954. Captain Noel, the intelligence officer, had brought the news to Colonel de Castries after his return from the airfield. Previous experience suggested that the enemy would attack at an hour when it would still be light enough for him to register his artillery fires, but too late for the French fighters based at Dien Bien Phu effectively to intervene in the battle, and for those based in Hanoi to intervene at all. March nights fall early in a deep valley located 20 degrees north of the equator. At the regular briefing of the senior commanders prior to dinner, de Castries went through the routine announcements, listened to the usual remarks, read a telegram from General Lauzun exhorting all pilots participating in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu to take exceptional risks, and then ended the briefing with the simple sentence, "Gentlemen, it's for tomorrow at 1700. As the French garrison readied itself for the showdown at Dien Bien Phu, it is useful to describe once more the final order of battle. As seen from the air or from the surrounding hills, Dien Bien Phu now looked like some gigantic primitive village whose population, not having mastered the art of building houses, had preferred to take shelter in holes in the ground. Inside the main center of resistance and on top of the main outlying positions, the last shreds of vegetation had completely disappeared. Only near Amarie and along the western flank of Claudine was there still any evidence of the original rice fields that had once existed there. There was no longer any trace of what had been the cluster of small hamlets and villages around the little town of Dien Bien Phu itself. The stately house of the pre-war French résident had stood on what was now Strongpoint Elian II, now occupied by Major Nicolas Moroccans. The buildings had been dismantled stone by stone to construct bunkers. Nicolas himself had used part of the cellar for his own command post, a move which led to the pleasant surprise of finding a small cache of 20-year-old bottles of French wine. A whole new road system, traced into the soil by the vehicles and tanks of the garrison, now connected the various strong points. Each strong point was more or less surrounded by barbed wire entanglements. At night, the roads and paths between them were closed with mobile barbed wire barriers. The peripheral positions had, in addition, been surrounded by conventional minefields and with electrically detonated bouncing mines, designed to devastate onrushing waves of enemy infantry after they had come through the barbed wire. In addition, the French engineers had dug into the slopes of the steeper hills 10-gallon drums of Nagel, jellied napalm, whose fiery flow, detonated by electrical triggers, would smother the attackers in flames and would transform them into human torches. Finally, key French positions had been equipped with sniper scope rifles whose infrared rays could spot an advancing enemy soldier on the darkest of nights. The strong points were connected to their own higher headquarters by wire and radio. All were similarly connected to de Castries' command post. In January 1954, de Castries had reorganized the whole position into three subsectors: the northern subsector, composed of strong points Amery and Gabriel, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Trancard, who had commanded the abandoned Lai Chau; a central subsector, comprising the main positions of Dien Bien Phu and outlying strong point Beatrice, under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Gaucher; and a southern subsector, under Lieutenant Colonel Lalanne.